All right, remember I said that as long as an mRNA molecule is intact, transcription will continue? Well, here we see in 19 that the transcription of an mRNA doesn't even have to go to completion before another round of transcription of that same mRNA gets started. What we have here is a complex called a polyribosome, which is one mRNA transcript, the red thing, and all of the ribosomes that are simultaneously transcribing it. So the direction of transcription is on this figure from left to right, and therefore this ribosome, which is just about to detach, has just finished transcribing, so you have the complete polypeptide being released. This one's a little bit behind, so it's not quite done, and this one's even less done, and so on. But they're all identical copies of the same purple polypeptide. As soon as a ribosome gets out of the way, then another one can come along and make another copy. So it makes translating I think I said transcription before. We're talking about translation here, not transcription. It makes translation of mRNA much more efficient to not wait to start until the previous one has been done. So that is a polyribosome. And also, that's a single messenger RNA transcript. Also, importantly, there's nothing saying that when you transcribe a gene, you only do it once, right? So a gene can be transcribed multiple times in quick succession to produce multiple different mRNAs that are, not different, they're distinct mRNAs, but they're all copies of each other. And each one then can be multiply translated by turning into a polyribosome. So expressing one gene can result in a lot of different copies of the ultimate polypeptide. All right, now to 20. What is the difference between a free ribosome and a bound ribosome? What is a free ribosome? Yes, a free ribosome is just on its own. It's not attached to a membrane. A bound ribosome is attached, at least at the moment, to a membrane, the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum. What is the job of the endoplasmic reticulum? Not exactly. The ribosomes are going to make the polypeptides regardless of what happens as far as the ER is concerned. But what is the job of specifically the rough endoplasmic reticulum, which is the part of the endoplasmic reticulum that features ribosomes on its membrane, giving it that roughness?
It takes up
Give it its specific what? Well, in a sense, yeah, but it does that by modifying it. That's the function of the rough ER. The rough ER actually modifies the protein somehow. All right. Well, not all polypeptides need modification. And all polypeptides start out being built, or at least the first part of the polypeptide, or even better to start that sentence as saying that translation always starts out on a free ribosome, just in the cytosol. And keep in mind, speaking of free and bound ribosomes, that they're the same ribosomes, just in different situations. So the ribosomes that are bound to the rough endoplasmic reticulum are only temporarily bound to that membrane. And before they were bound to the membrane, they were free ribosomes. Okay? Also keep in mind that no ribosome is complete, meaning the two subunits together, until a messenger RNA is already connected to the small ribosomal subunit, starting out translation. That's the initiation part of translation. And what I was saying before is that translation always begins on a free ribosome. That's where the two subunits come in and clamp the mRNA between them, just not associated with a membrane. All right. Now, some polypeptides are going to not only start out being built in the cytoplasm, but end up there as well. And that's because those kinds of polypeptides are not going to require any modification after translation. If there is modification, we call it post-translational modification. Right, we talked earlier about post-transcriptional modification. That's modification of mRNA after transcription has already created the mRNA, right? Here we're talking about a polypeptide that's created by translation, but then after translation needs to be modified. Those proteins undergo, therefore, what is called post-translational modification. And that's only some of the polypeptides, not all of them. But even the ones that need modification start out the translation process on a free ribosome. The polypeptides that are going to require post-translational modification need to be delivered to the organelle that's responsible for post-translational modification. And that is the rough endoplasmic reticulum. That's its job, to modify newly made polypeptides. The rough ER won't have a job to do for the other polypeptides that don't need post-translational modification. So the question is, how does the cell know which polypeptides do need modification and which ones don't? What we see in this slide is that the first several amino acids in the polypeptide that is being built but has not yet completely been built, that sequence of amino acids actually, which is part of the polypeptide, serves as a signal to tell the cell, I'm one that's going to need to be modified. And we can see that right here on this free ribosome. Like I said, translation always starts on a free ribosome for all polypeptides. But in this case it's three. There's not saying it's necessarily three amino acids, but these first three amino acids, that specific sequence, serves as a signal called a signal peptide, and tells the cell that you can't finish the translation process here on the free ribosome because I am one of those proteins that needs to be modified, and therefore you need to get me over to the rough endoplasmic reticulum. So keep things straight as far as what kind of molecules we're working with here. The signal peptide is part of the growing polypeptide, which is a protein. And that signal peptide, which is part of the protein being created, is recognized by another protein in orange here called the signal recognition particle. All right, that's two proteins involved so far. Just like a substrate is specific for an enzyme, this signal peptide is recognized specifically by this signal recognition particle. And when there's a binding of those two, that causes translocation of the entire translation complex, meaning the mRNA, both subunits of the ribosome, the emerging polypeptide itself, plus the signal recognition particle that's now connected to the whole thing, gets translocated, moved over to the membrane of the rough endoplasmic reticulum and docks there somewhere. This involves still another, more protein. The little pinkish thing in the membrane here is one of several different translocation complexes, which are pores, really. They're holes in the membrane, similar to the nuclear pores, which are complexes of proteins that have a hollow interior, so they act like a little tunnel. All right. So that's a third protein involved here. And the translocation complex protein can bind to the signal recognition particle that has just recognized that this is one of those proteins that needs modification. And that's what I meant when I said it docks. And when it does that, it positions the emerging polypeptide that's being created in the right position for it to be strung through. As it gets longer and longer, it's going to get strung through the hollow interior of this pore and find itself in the lumen of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, which is exactly where it needs to be for it to be modified in whatever way is appropriate for that polypeptide. You see, so this is the same thing in different shots in time. These aren't different ribosomes. It's the same one continuing to build the polypeptide. It's getting longer and longer, but it's being strung into the lumen of the ER. Now, if a polypeptide does not have a signal peptide as its first several amino acids, then the cell won't recognize it. You know, there won't be a signal recognition particle that recognizes those amino acids, and therefore it will just continue being translated in the cytoplasm and then released in the cytoplasm, which is appropriate in that case because that would be one of the ones that does not need post-translational modification. So one of those kinds of polypeptides will simply, after being released from the ribosome, simply fold up into three-dimensional shape based on its sequence, and that will be the appropriate shape to do the appropriate job for that protein. All right, now let's talk about mutations. Slide 21. We've talked a little bit about mutations already, and we will more after this upcoming test. But mutation as a term simply refers to any change in a DNA sequence compared to what it was before. That can happen in different ways for different reasons and to different degrees, involving as little as one single base pair, one nucleotide, in other words, or it can involve a large-scale change at the chromosome level. We'll talk about that later. Here, though, we're talking about small-scale changes to DNA, which are called point mutations because it does involve just a single nucleotide. And we actually have looked at this example before when we first talked about mutation. This is the mutation that leads to sickle cell disease in humans. On the left, we have one gene, and not nearly the entire gene. We're looking at just one triplet within a gene. But it's a gene that codes, that helps code for hemoglobin. I say helps code for hemoglobin because hemoglobin is a multimeric protein. It has four polypeptides, but two identical of one type and two identical polypeptides of a different type, four overall. But since there are two different kinds of polypeptides involved, that means a single hemoglobin requires two different genes to code for it, because each gene codes for one of the two polypeptide types. All right. The other polypeptide, which is required for hemoglobin, is not shown on here, and that's not affected by this mutation. This mutation that we're looking at occurs in just one of the two genes. And the gene has many more triplets than just this one, but only this triplet is involved in the mutation. In fact, only one of the three nucleotides. That's why it's a point mutation. But you see the phrase wild type here, and wild type simply refers to the version of DNA that is most often found in organisms in a population. Now, of course, even what we're calling the wild type DNA has mutated. That's the reason it's part of a certain species. If there were no mutation happening, then we would all be identical copies of the first original successful cells that we descended from. So even wild type is mutated DNA, but when it's the most often encountered version of DNA in a population, we call it the wild type, and anything that's different from that is considered to be mutant form. All right, so the wild type hemoglobin DNA is one that will, if it's transcribed and then that RNA is translated into the polypeptide, will form normal hemoglobin, whose job it is to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide. It does that job very well, the normal version. All right, so all of the other triplets that are not shown here are the same in both the wild type and the mutant version. It's only a single nucleotide that actually gets changed in this mutation. And you can see here that originally you have CTT, but that's mutating into CAT. In other words, an adenine instead of a thymine in this position. Well, when a mutation occurs and is not noticed by a cell, then the cell doesn't realize it's a mutation, right? It's just one of the four possible letters in that position. And so it can operate still the same way as it does if it weren't mutated. The cell is just going to assume that that's what the DNA is supposed to be, right? Well, in wild-type hemoglobin, this CTT triplet, when it gets transcribed in that messenger RNA, is going to be transcribed as the complement of that, right? GAA. And when you look up GAA in the genetic code, you see that it specifies glutamic acid, which is what the GLU stands for. That specific amino acid. All right? Well, in the mutant form, CAT in the DNA is going to be transcribed correctly, but when you correctly transcribe CAT, that makes GUA, not GAA. And GUA in the genetic code specifies a different amino acid, not glutamic acid, but valine. All the other amino acids are correct and in the correct position. It's just this one amino acid of many making up the polypeptide in hemoglobin that will misshape it and cause sickle cell disease. So a point mutation, even though it's the smallest possible mutation as far as how much DNA is involved, can still have a profound change, make a profound difference to the life of the organism. This also points out, by the way, what I've said several times, which is that DNA doesn't directly give an organism its traits. The protein gives the organism its traits. It's the fact that valine is in this position instead of glutamic acid that gives that polypeptide its new shape that makes it not able to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide as well. So that's the trait. Having the disease is the trait, and that's directly caused by the actual polypeptide. So that's a specific example. In 22, we're looking at generic examples to see that we can categorize these mutations based on what effect they have. You have wild-type DNA at the top, and then each of these is some mutation, some change from that wild type. But depending on how the change is made, what the mutation is, the effect can be either nothing or very drastic. On this left column, we have, these are all examples of what are called base pair substitutions. Now, a base pair is a single nucleotide position. but it's called a base pair because DNA is two-stranded. So a nucleotide in one position and the other nucleotide in the same position on the other strand make up a base pair. Two nitrogenous bases is one base pair. But if you have a base pair substitution, what that phrase tells you is that one base pair is substituted for the wild-type base pair, meaning that one is swapped for the other. It's not added or subtracted. It's swapped. And therefore, the overall number of nucleotides doesn't change. The number of nucleotides doesn't change, right? Just the specific base in one position is different. And that's going to be really important for something I'll explain in a bit. This first example of a base pair substitution is categorized as a silent mutation. It has nothing to do with sound. It just means that it's a mutation that, even though it is a mutation, it's a change in DNA, doesn't have at all any effect on the organism because it ends up that the normal protein is made anyway. And the reason that that can be, the reason that a change in DNA can actually result in no change in the polypeptide is for what? What explains that to you? What do you know about the genetic code that could explain that? Right. You have redundancy of the genetic code. Simply because 64 is greater than 20, right? You need to specify 20 amino acids. You have 64 combinations of three nucleotides in RNA to do that job, and there are 64 combinations. So you have more than enough codons to specify all 20 amino acids. Therefore, you can have more than one codon specifying the same amino acid. A silent mutation is one that, even though it's different DNA and will specify in transcription a different triplet in RNA, it will result, nevertheless, in the correct amino acid being laid down because this new codon is specifying the same amino acid by redundancy as the wild-type codon would. You see what I mean? You see what I mean by that? The original DNA here on the top strand is CCG. That would specify GGC in the messenger RNA. You look that up, it's glycine. Well, it gets mutated. This G gets mutated into an A, CCA instead of CCG. That's going to be transcribed into GGU instead of GGC, but GGU and GGC are redundant. They both specify glycine in the genetic code, and therefore, even though the nucleic acids are different, the polypeptide that's going to be translated will be the same. And it has absolutely no effect on the trait, therefore. It's just two different ways of making the same protein. That doesn't have to be the case, though. It's just kind of the luck of the draw. In this case, in the middle left, you have what's called a missense mutation. Missense refers to getting a word wrong, by analogy with language. Words, in this analogy, are codons. So the same exact thing is happening. One nucleotide gets changed in the original DNA. It happens to be this one. So you have TCG instead of CCG. Well, that's going to be transcribed into AGC instead of GGC. But AGC, when you look it up in the genetic code, is not glycine. It corresponds to serine instead. So in this case, the rest of the polypeptide is correct as far as its amino acids are concerned, except that serine is at this position instead of glycine. One amino acid difference, just like, you know, this is exactly the same thing that happened in the previous slide with sickle cell disease. One amino acid is different, therefore it has a different shape, and therefore doesn't perform its function the same. By the way, random mutations, which are just accidents, sometimes create a differently shaped protein that actually works better than the wild type. And this is exactly what natural selection selects for, right? If it's a random accident that makes an improved protein, then that's going to benefit the organisms that have that mutation, and they're going to have a higher chance of passing on that mutated version to the next generation. That's why we are not all identical copies of the original cell. There are all kinds of organisms because of mutation that has been favored. But anyway, that's a missense. And because it's like getting one word of a sentence wrong. But if that happens, even though it's not much of an error, it can make a big difference, right? To the meaning of the sentence. Nonsense is more severe in its effect. Once again, same thing happening. It's one substitution. In this case, this A, which is supposed to be TTC, it is ATC. Well, when you transcribe that, it's going to turn it into UAG. That's not only a different codon, that happens to be one of the three stop codons. So, however far along translation has gotten to that point, this kind of mutation tells it to stop right there, prematurely. This is not supposed to be the end of the polypeptide. But since the mutation points to a stop codon, it's going to tell it to stop. And therefore, has very, very little chance of that kind of protein, which is shorter than usual, doing its job. And the effect is going to be more pronounced. But that's the difference between nonsense and missense. Nonsense is getting a hell of a lot more wrong because you've stopped reading the sentence. Those are all substitutions, none of which changes the overall length. But on the right, we see insertions and deletions. It doesn't matter whether it's an insertion or a deletion, either one of those is going to change the overall number of nucleotides. Because you're not swapping one for another. You're either putting an additional nucleotide in there, which is what an insertion is, and shoving all the rest to the side, or you're taking one out and not replacing it with anything. That's what a deletion is. Now, speaking of this analogy with language, codons are like words, but the difference is that in English, we use words of different lengths, right? Words can be one letter or several letters. And when we're reading, it's pretty easy to tell where words are separated from each other because we use spaces. But there aren't any spaces used in the genetic code. There aren't spaces between codons, right? So there needs to be a reading frame that's set telling the ribosome, this is the first word. There's no spaces, it's just a sequence of letters, but since the ribosome knows that it reads every word as three letters, once it knows where the first word is, it will just go down three letters at a time. All right? So by analogy with language, let's just use a simple sentence in which only three-letter words are used, which is not all that difficult to come up with in English. Like, the red cat ate the owl, we'll say. Right, that has a specific meaning. Well, a substitution would be, you know, like replacing this E of red with a Y. Yeah, you get that one word wrong, but the rest of it is still right. Because you've maintained the reading frame. An insertion, though, would be like putting an additional E, for instance, in between there. That's not going to affect just that word. It's going to affect everything thereafter, right? It's going to turn it into the R-E-E, D-C-A, T-A-T, E-T-H, E-O-W, You see where those come from? Inserting it here shifts everything over one, and therefore the ribosome is reading three at a time, and those are totally different words from the point of the mutation onward. And similarly, if you just take one out, which would be an deletion, everything shifts as well. So the effect is much more widespread than in a substitution, because it doesn't affect just that one amino acid. It affects every amino acid after the point of the mutation. So you're going to, in effect, making a totally random protein that has effectively zero chance of working to function how it's supposed to. And therefore, it's harder to survive such a mutation, because you're going to not ever bank in a protein that does the job that it's supposed to. You can still classify insertions and deletions, though, based on how they operate. For instance, you can have an insertion or a deletion that leads to a premature stop. That's nonsense. Or just extensive missense, where each word is wrong after that point. Each codon is still specifying an amino acid, so it's not nonsense. But it's extensive missense, because every word is incorrect. Well, when we discussed the difference in gene expression between the two major types of cells, I said that the reason there is a difference has to do with the fact that prokaryotic cells are not compartmentalized, right? They have only the cytoplasm, that's where the DNA is. In any cell, transcription has to occur where the DNA is. Well, that's the cytoplasm for a prokaryote. Translation occurs in the cytoplasm in all cells. But in a prokaryotic cell, that's the same chamber, same compartment for both of those processes, transcription and translation. Can't have what's pictured here happening in a eukaryotic cell, because transcription has to end before translation starts, since you have to get that transcript, once it's produced, out of the nucleus and into the cytoplasm to start translation. A prokaryotic cell doesn't have that complication, and in fact, it can start translating mRNA before that mRNA is even completely transcribed. You can see this here. We have the blue gene. This is the DNA. And you have multiple different RNA polymerases simultaneously transcribing that same gene, leading to multiple copies of mRNA, each red one. All right? So multiple mRNAs coming off of the transcription assembly line, but as soon as there's enough room, enough RNA nucleotides added to that transcript for there to be room for a ribosome to come along and clamp onto it, it will do so and start translating the mRNA before the mRNA is even complete. So you have here multiple different polyribosomes hanging off of the DNA, not even yet fully transcribed. You see the difference between this and what I showed you earlier as just a single polyribosome? A polyribosome can occur in a eukaryotic cell, but that's after the mRNA has gotten out of the nucleus. It's no longer still being transcribed. Here you have an mRNA that's not even done being transcribed, and it's already forming a polyribosome. So in a prokaryotic cell, they can get a lot of copies of the polypeptide, whatever it is specified by this gene, ramped up in short order, which can be important because a single-celled organism can't make any delays in getting a necessary protein produced, right? If we lose a cell, no big deal. You lose a cell if you're a unicellular organism and you're dead. So it's good that they don't have that complication and can get a bunch of copies of the polypeptide made very quickly. Number 24 is no new information. It's the last slide of the unit, and it's just really a summary of this chapter, summary of gene expression, and specifically it's a summary of gene expression in a eukaryotic cell. As you see, there's a nucleus here. So it's worth it to go through this, even though I've taught you all this already. Transcription is the only part of gene expression that actually directly involves the gene, directly involves the DNA. And that happens first. And remember, it's called transcription because there's not a change in language. There's just a rewriting of the information that's originally in nucleic acid language in the form of DNA. It gets rewritten in the form of nucleic acid language in RNA form. And that involves RNA polymerase to bind at the promoter and then read the gene, read one strand of the DNA only. Only one of the strands of DNA is used in transcription, unlike for replication. And that will make a longer and longer mRNA transcript until the RNA polymerase gets to the end of the gene.
Since this is a...
eukaryotic cell that we're talking about, the RNA that's produced is called pre-mRNA because it needs to be post-transcriptionally modified. That comes in two major modification forms. One is the addition of the ends, the poly A tail and the 5' cap, and also the splicing of introns out and the sewing together of the exons. That involves a spliceosome, as we talked about. Well, the modification, the putting the ends on, allows this mature mRNA, the final mRNA version, to get out of the nucleus through a nuclear pore and go to the cytoplasm, which is where translation occurs. And that will involve initiation of transcription, which we see here on the left edge. The two ribosomal subunits are not together until an mRNA first binds to the small ribosomal subunit, and then later the large subunit comes along. But one codon at a time gets read by the ribosome, and according to the genetic code, that will allow the addition of just the correct kind of amino acid being brought in by an aminoacyl tRNA carrying that amino acid. And what ensures that it's the right kind of tRNA is there has to be complementarity between the anticodon of the aminoacyl tRNA and the codon of the mRNA. Then there's transfer of however many amino acids are carried by the peptidyl tRNA in the P slot to the amino acid of the aminoacyl tRNA, making that tRNA the new peptidyl tRNA, and making the former peptidyl tRNA an uncharged tRNA, which gets put into the exit slot and then ejected. And then a shifting, we'll just do this over and over. That's the elongation phase. Eventually, a shift will get to the codon that is one of the three stop codons that are possible, and that will tell the ribosome, you've already added the final amino acid, it's done, it's time to disintegrate this translation complex, and the polypeptide will be on its own, but the mRNA will still be there until it's destroyed, so the same thing can happen again several times. All right, any questions? Yeah.
So, transcription and translation are happening at the same time?
Well, yes, because, for one reason, transcription...
I mean, that starts it with...
Transcription is always happening to some number of genes. We studied it as though just one gene is being transcribed, but at any given moment, many genes are being transcribed, right? But also, just if you concentrate on just one gene, it's possible for transcription and translation to simultaneously occur because you don't have to stop with just one transcript, right? While you're still making more and more copies of mRNA, some of those first mRNA copies can be now being translated in the cytoplasm, making the first copies of the polypeptide. But eventually, the gene will be turned off again because you've made enough of that stuff. And, you know, it's more the norm for a gene to be turned off than turned on. Keep in mind that every cell in your body has all of the genes. It has the entire library, each cell. But no cell ever comes close to turning all of those on, otherwise you're in trouble. Right? You don't want your liver to be making toenails, but it has the capability to because it has the genes. It's just that those genes are turned off on a cell-by-cell basis. That's part of specializing as a certain kind of cell. They turn certain genes on and certain other genes off. Any other questions?
It's the entire DNA sequence that gets transcribed and then the changes from the splicing, right? Do you think that mRNA is
Not the entire DNA sequence. The entire DNA sequence of one gene. But there are thousands of genes on one chromosome and even more DNA between the chromosomes. Replication, yes, the entire length of DNA gets copied because you have to make a completely new chromosome. But transcription occurs at one gene at a time, which is a tiny subset of the overall sequence. But yes, you're right in that that whole sequence of the gene gets transcribed, making one long pre-mRNA, but then, depending on how the splicing goes, you could make multiple different versions of mature mRNA, which could lead to multiple different polypeptides being made. Yeah?
Does polyribosomes need that multiple same protein at one end?
Yeah, because you have, for each of the ribosomes that are on a polyribosome, it's making one copy of the polypeptide. But whether it's a polyribosome or not, if a mRNA is still there, hasn't been digested yet, and more ribosomes attached to it, it's going to be exactly the same polypeptide that's built because it reads exactly the same codons each time. The only way you can have a different polypeptide being built corresponding to the same gene is if it's spliced differently to end up with a different mature mRNA. And that wouldn't happen unless the conditions in the cell were different. That's part of controlling which way a pre-mRNA gets spliced. That's what I was talking about when I mentioned alternative mRNA splicing.
Did you have polyribosomes
both what? Yes. Yeah, the only difference would be where they go. All the copies, if it were bound, would be going into the lumen and being modified the same way. If it were free ribosomes, a free polyribosome, then they would just all be released into the cytoplasm and all be identical to each other.
Do they all have to attach in the cytoplasm first before they all move into the ER?
Attached to what? Well, yes, that would involve each ribosome would be attached to a different translocation complex. So each individual copy of the polypeptide would be strung through a different hole. But it would all be connected by the mRNA that holds it all together. Because a polyribosome is a single mRNA transcript and multiple ribosomes simultaneously translating it. Did you have a question? I thought you...
Is DNA the only thing that could be mutated?
No. You could accidentally make the wrong mRNA, for instance, and that would be a temporary effect, because if you go back and transcribe the DNA again, since the DNA hasn't been changed, it would make the correct form of mRNA. It's just that that would be hard to detect because it wouldn't be a permanent thing. But once it's DNA that's mutated, the cell doesn't know that it's changed. It just obeys that new code, and that's what's permanent. Not only permanent for that individual, but if that individual reproduces, will pass that mutation on to the ants, to the what do they call them? Offspring. And that's exactly when natural selection occurs. Natural selection, that's when evolution occurs, not within the lifetime of an individual. Individuals don't evolve. Populations evolve between generations. Anything else?
Does DNA die?
Well, DNA is not alive to begin with. It's just a molecule. And, you know, organisms themselves are just molecules. But being alive simply means undergoing the reactions that make up metabolism. And when metabolism stops, that is death. You still have the molecules there, they're just no longer working chemically.
Are hereditary mutations that get passed down, is it just luck of the draw, whether it actually does anything or not, like breast cancer can get passed down?
Yeah. All mutations are random, and what determines whether or not they get passed on is whether or not what kind of cell they occur in. So our bodies, the longer we live, are accumulating more and more mutations. But almost all of the cells of our body are ones that are never going to be passed on. A mutation that has any hope of being passed on has to occur in a germline cell that creates gametes, sperm or egg. Those will be passed on. A mutation in my skin, never going to be passed on even if I did procreate. Right? Because this has nothing to do with my sperm. Yeah?
Do you have a test I want to say?
Well, what does the syllabus say?
Yes.
And that's not... Is that somehow ambiguous?
No, it's not.
Yes, we do. A little less than 2 days from now. All right, I'll turn this off.